Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking about the new film from Errol Morris, Standard Operating Procedure.
Oh good, I like trouble.
So, this is J. Robert Parks. You're probably wondering why you're hearing my voice instead of the mellifluous tones of Robert Davis. It's a funny story. You might recall a couple podcasts ago, Rob related this hilarious anecdote about Steven Spielberg and a pig in Dubuque, Iowa. Yeah, I laughed. I told all my friends, as I'm sure you did. Well, it turns out that one of our listeners knows Steven Spielberg's dog trainer. And like that game of telephone that you might have played in third grade, you know, the one where you whisper a story into someone's ear and he whispers it to someone else and so forth and so on until the story is completely mangled? Well, the same thing happened here. The friend told the dog trainer who told someone else and so forth until finally Spielberg heard it, and he was not amused. And I don't need to tell you that that man has some crazy lawyers. So Rob has been a bit preoccupied. But he wanted me to assure you that he will be back for the next podcast. And he also wanted to pass on a message to Brad that he will call you about the vacuum cleaner. But whatever you do, don't sell it. Today we're talking about standard operating procedure. Now, if you've listened to our last podcast, you know that Rob and I have already talked about this film at some length. But since that conversation, I had a chance to interview Errol Morris, and Rob saw the movie for a second time. So we thought it would be fun to devote an entire podcast to the documentary, where we'd pair the interview with a second conversation Rob and I had, in which we discussed how our ideas and opinions of the movie had changed. Now, if you haven't seen the film, it's a documentary about Abu Ghraib. But unlike many Iraq movies, this one is specific, as Errol Morris focuses on the infamous photographs that were taken at the prison outside Baghdad in late 2003. He investigates the photos, putting them in order and asking what the photos show us and what they don't show us. He asks whether they've been altered and cropped and what are the implications of that. Morris also had a chance to interview many of the soldiers who took the photographs, and he asked them why they did it, you know, what they were thinking and what the situation in the prison was like. Now I need to say a couple of things about the interview. First, it begins with a blunder. I interviewed Morris about 4 years ago, and I thought it would be clever to begin this conversation by referencing that one. But somehow I misread my notes, and I ended up misquoting Morris, and he called me on it, and it leads to a somewhat awkward moment. Rob and I talked about editing it out of the podcast, but that seems somewhat dishonest. And I'll admit I like the irony of starting a conversation that revolves around mistakes with a mistake of my own. Unfortunately, that wasn't the only mistake I made. Somehow I accidentally turned off my own mic for half of the interview, which meant that I had to later re-record all of my questions and comments. For many radio interviews, this idea of re-recording parts of interviews is standard operating procedure, excuse the pun, and you probably wouldn't have noticed it if I hadn't mentioned it. But again, there's a delicious irony at work in that I had to reenact part of an interview that, as you'll soon hear, focuses on reenactments. And now, hopefully without any more mistakes, my conversation with Errol Morris. I'd like to pick up where we left off. 4 years ago, we talked about the fog of war, and I ended the discussion by asking you to name several documentaries that you particularly liked, and which you did. But then you went out of your way to talk about how much you disliked Shoah, the nine-hour. That's what I have on the tape. I think Night and Fog. Oh, Night and Fog. Wow, I went back to the tape. I thought it was Shoah, but maybe I misinterpreted.
I don't think so.
Well, let me ask you this, then.
I don't like Night and Fog. I do like Shoah.
Oh, well, then that's actually an even more interesting question for me.
And I have ranted about Night and Fog in the past, so it makes at least some kind of sense to me.
Well, that helps me then, because let me ask this. It's the same question, but different. Why do you prefer your style of filmmaking to, say, that of Night and Fog? In other words, why is that for you a more appropriate documentary choice?
I don't know if this is an issue of style as much as it is an issue of content. I think it's very easy to make a movie decrying the terrible, terrible, terrible things that we have done. My co-writer on the book that comes out next month, Standard Operating Procedure, mm-hmm. Philip Gurevich, at the end of his Rwanda book, which is a terrific
it's
book.
It's a great book.
He says, much easier to decry evil than to do good.
Mm.
A sentiment that I agree with. There were so many controversies about Night and Fog. This is a discussion in and of itself. Mm. In order for the movie to be shown at Cannes, they had to delete all of the material that referred to French complicity in the Holocaust.
Mm.
It was a sanitized movie. It was a movie that was vague.
Mm.
Shoah, on the other hand, is a movie about evidence.
Mm.
Is a movie that actually brings forward first-person
yep.
narratives in a very, very, very powerful way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a truly great movie.
Mm. How would you say your films, which also obviously are often dependent upon interviews, is trying to do similar things or different?
I think that what I'm doing is different. Similar, yes, in the sense that I'm very much interested in first-person narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an essential part of the movie.
Yep.
Different because I had all of these photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes describe making a movie as very similar to baking a cake. You put your ingredients in front of you. In this case, the essential ingredients were the photographs, the evidence. These are the actual photographs that were taken in fall of 2003 at Abu Ghraib. These first-person accounts by the people who took the photographs, what they were doing, what they were photographing, so on and so forth, and reenactments, which do a whole number of different things. Mm-hmm. They call your attention to important pieces mm-hmm. of the first-person narrative.
Right.
They take you into the world of the photograph.
How did you go about getting the interviews you did? Because I know it was over a period of many months.
Actually, it was a period of more than a year. People were in prison. In the case of Lindy England, I had to wait a year and a half for her to be released by the military. The military was not allowing any kind of access to her.
Is that typical, or was that just for these people?
I haven't really tried in the past to get into military prisons. I think it's gotten worse across the board in the last 10 years. In the Thin Blue Line, I would actually come into prisons with a film crew. You know, we would be given complete access. People, if anything, bent over backwards trying to help us actually do this filming. Nowadays, it's a very different kind of story.
You likened it to ingredients in a cake. As you're doing these interviews, do you have a sense of the structure of the film or what the structure of the film will be? Or does that all take place in the editing room?
I certainly had a sense that I wanted to structure the movie around the photographs, that the movie essentially was based on the photographs. And then I stumbled on this extraordinary document. I did not know it. At the very beginning, I found it fairly early on, this timeline created by Brent Pack, who was one of the chief investigators for the Army. And so he was able to analyze the metadata. He took the EXIF, the EXIF files from these cameras, and was able to order the photographs chronologically. He was able to ascertain which camera took which photographs, and so on and so forth. So there was a chronology, and I tried to follow it, for better or for worse. Tricky business, because chronology doesn't always make good drama.
How would you say you followed it, in the order of the interviews, or in the way in which you investigated the photographs?
The photographs are roughly in chronological order in the movie. So there was that inherent structure that came from the photographs themselves.
You did Linda England's interview last because you had to wait for her to get out of prison.
It's the last interview that's in the movie. I actually did a couple of interviews after that I did not put in standard operating procedure.
Because they didn't work as well?
Yeah. You know, the problem with movies, unlike books, is there's a limit to how much you can actually, probably it's also true of books in a different way, but there's a limit to how much you can actually cram into a movie without the movie self-destructing.
Was it easier that you knew you were going to do the book with Gurevich so that the material you couldn't use in the film would get out in other ways?
In many ways, it's given me slight peace of mind. It's probably true of every movie I've worked on, particularly The Thin Blue Line. I felt there's this incredible story that isn't really part of the movie at all. And there's this wealth of information that I've been able to dig up that isn't in the movie at all. And Philip and I had this idea. Neither of us was particularly interested in creating a book version of a movie. I didn't need Philip to do that. I thought it would be far more interesting for him to take this material and create something new, something quite independent of the movie. And that's what he did.
All of your interviews are with relatively low-level soldiers, except for General Karpinski, who was forced to take the fall. Did you try to interview higher-ranking officials and just didn't get any takers?
I would be happy to interview all of those high-ranking guys. And I did try to. I'm not sure that they would fit in this movie.
Okay, why?
Because it's about the photographs and those guys who took them. There's this idea, this crazy idea, that you're only supposed to make one Iraq movie, and you're supposed to make it again and again and again and again and again and again. People wonder why they don't go to these things. I think part of it is because the same thing is being said repeatedly. Everybody knows. Look, one of the amazing things about this story is that we have so much evidence on all of these people. The higher-ups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People choose not to see it, and people choose not to act on it. I wanted to tell a very different kind of story. The flip side of the fog of war, if you like. The guys at the bottom of the chain of command, not at the very, very top. And I think it's an important story. I also think...
Why? To give them a chance to have their say?
Why? Because a whole number of reasons. Because there is something really interesting about the story of these photographs. By the way, I think we've got it all wrong. I don't think we understand the photographs or what is in the photographs at all.
Why?
Why? I think photographs lie. Or we help them to tell untruth. No one bothered to look further than the photographs, assuming they already knew everything they had to know about them. I think that's really interesting.
My experience was that I had seen all the photographs before with the appropriate parts blurred out. But when I saw a standard operating procedure, as well as when I saw a Taxi to the Dark Side, and I had a chance to see the photos uncensored, I was really surprised at how much more shocking they were. Even though I knew it had been blurred or cropped out, seeing the pictures raw, so to speak, was much more powerful than I expected them to be.
That's interesting. To me, it's the photographs, but it's certainly the idea of these photographs. To me, they've been little mysteries. Each one of them is, for me, a mystery that needs to be investigated. It was one of the reasons I enjoyed making this movie. I still think about the photographs. I still think about how the public understands them versus what they might really be.
There's a wonderful line in the movie about the limitations of photographs. It goes, "The pictures only show you a fraction of a second. You don't see forward or backward. You don't see outside the frame. But that raises an interesting question. What are the limitations of film? What can't film show us?
Limitations of everything. I mean, we have various kinds of ways of mirroring the world for ourselves, reenacting the world for ourselves. And there are inherent limitations in all of them. There's this idea that truth is handed over to us in some simple way. You do this, you do that, truth pops out like a Pop-Tart in a toaster oven. And it doesn't work that way. We keep investigating, we keep thinking, we keep striving to figure out what in hell is going on out there.
And yet when most people see a documentary, their sense is that it's true.
Well, that's their mistake.
Right. But I think that's really fascinating that for most people, when they see something, say, as untrue as reality TV, the fact that it's a moving image fools the people in assuming that it is reality. So they see a documentary and think it's true, even more than a photograph. So to go back to the original question, what do you think is a film's limitation?
I don't think that the limitations are any different from the general limitations that it's part of our way of looking at the world. And the world really isn't inside of our skulls. I just wrote a series of essays on reenactments for the New York Times where I finished the essay by saying everything is a reenactment. Reality, as we perceive it, consciousness of reality is something reenacted inside of our heads. I mean, we could talk endlessly about images and moving images and their relationship to the world. Movies are very powerful. There's a line from Shakespeare's Othello that Philip Gurevich is very fond of, I'm very fond of as well, where Othello demands of Iago, bring me the ocular proof. And by the ocular proof, he means he wants to see something visual. Vision for us is privileged. We see something, we tend to believe it. Of course, the deep irony here is thinking back on the story that Shakespeare created, Iago brings Othello the quote-unquote ocular proof, but it's not proof of anything at all. He has been horribly, horribly manipulated and deceived. Something always to keep in mind. I am a great believer in skepticism. I think skepticism is what makes progress possible. Without it, we would be in really, really bad shape.
There's a great line in your New York Times piece on reenactments. You wrote, "Memory is an elastic affair. We remember selectively, just as we perceive selectively." And you're talking about how we only perceive parts of things because we can't take it all in. You know, what do we perceive? What don't we perceive? What I find particularly interesting is how our memories are shaped and then even replaced by images. And I was curious, as you were interviewing the people, and obviously they have memories of Abu Ghraib, but they've also been forced to look at and confront these photographs over and over and over again. Do you think their perceptions of that event have been more about the photographs than about the actual event?
It's hard to know. I think one of the reasons why we take photographs is to help us remember the past. And I think inevitably those photographs in turn help shape the past for us. It's not a one-way street, as it were. The photograph influences us in many, many, many different ways and may come to replace the past in some way. What you're saying, I think, is absolutely true and really, really interesting. Is one of the reasons that the movie still interests me is you can actually go to this movie and you can see people recalling events. You can see them dealing with the photographs, on the other hand. you can see the play actually between the two, between personal recollection and photography. And I think that is really interesting.
There's an aspect of standard operating procedure that I find troubling.
Oh, good. I like trouble.
It's not with the reenactments. I really appreciate what you did in Thin Blue Line, and I don't have any trouble with the reenactments here. But I am troubled by how stylized they are.
Any more so than in the Thin Blue Line?
For me, the troubling aspect is with the contrast between these really grainy and ugly photographs and what I assume is Robert Richardson's really beautiful cinematography with the really stark lighting and the close-ups and the slow motion of blood. And so I was curious why you chose such a strong contrast.
Well, you know, this is a battle that you can't win. If I made the reenactments look too much like the photographs, I would be accused of trying to fool people, to blur the difference between the actual photographs and the material that I was creating around them. That was very much a conscious choice, yeah, that we should make the reenactments look so completely different, yeah, from the photographs that there can be no chance, no possibility that people are going to confuse the two. It's anachronistic, but when I show the photographs, they always have a white border around them. You don't see photographs like that anymore. Or since printing of photographs, you'd send your photographs to Kodak and they'd come back in the old days on photographic paper with a nice border. I put the white border on them to remind the viewer, these are the photographs. I haven't cropped them. I haven't changed them. This is what was taken in the fall of 2003 at Abu Ghraib. And the photographs are more or less square in shape. This is my first film in CinemaScope, which has an aspect ratio of 2.4 to 1. The length of the frame is nearly 2.5 times the height of the frame. And it looks completely different.
And again, was that a conscious choice to show these as are the reenactments and these are the photos?
That's correct. Yes, it's trying to break them apart very, very, very deliberately in so many ways, by the use of the white borders, by the aspect ratio, by the use of slow-mo, and on and on and on and on and on and on. I actually have been unhappy with several of my efforts at reenactments in the past. Having just written about it, I think it is important. Going back to the cake, the ingredients that we were talking about. You want your ingredients to stand out. They're all essential to what you're doing, but you don't want them all blurred. I like that people know what's a reenactment. I like the fact they know what is a real photograph coming out of Abu Ghraib, and they know it's an interview.
Okay.
Bam, bam, bam. Yeah. So, but go back.
Mm-hmm.
Having said this, have I convinced you or you're still unhappy?
Well,
I don't want to...
I understand. I understand the motivation, and that helps me. One of the things, to go back to our earlier point about the power of images, a line I like a great deal that comes from a French theorist, Jean Baudrillard, talks about how there's a primal pleasure in images. They are brutally fascinating. And he goes on to argue that because of that, they are immoral. Because we tend to react to an image by just appreciating it rather than thinking about it. And his whole point is that they sort of short-circuit our ability to think critically. You know, if I read something, my antenna is up. Do I believe this is true? Do I believe this is not true? Whereas if I watch a movie, particularly a beautiful movie, I tend not to ask those questions.
That in order to interest yourself in the question of truth, you have to see Grain?
No, but I think there's a connotation to grain, right? I mean, it's, in other words, there's...
But that's bad.
Yes, no, I know. It's
By the way, if you want to talk about immorality, let me give you an example of what I would consider immorality. Jean Baudrillard, for the attempt to argue the truth might be subjective and that the world as such might not exist. I like to think that everything I do is in reaction to that idea. Okay. Yeah. I'm a great believer. It's one thing to say that images can be seductive, that we can be fooled by images, that images can take control over our minds and influence us in so many diverse ways. That's all true, and I believe it. I also believe in truth. I believe that there is a truth out there and that we must be enjoined to pursue it.
Mm.
And the Baudrillard idea I find deeply disturbing and troublesome.
The idea that there is no truth or that it's all subjective.
That's correct. Yeah.
No, and I... Yeah.
Don't like it. Don't agree with it. Don't believe it. I once was told by someone that the postmodernists believe in the subjectivity of truth until it comes time for tenure.
One of the 11 lessons of life from the life of Robert McNamara says that belief and seeing are both often wrong.
Yes. You know, this just parenthetically, there's something very odd about how people have taken these 11 lessons. McNamara, of course, knew from the get-go they weren't his 11 lessons.
Right, right.
They were abstracted from things he said that I had put in the movie.
Right.
The lessons to me, and I think this is very important, are all ironic lessons.
Yes.
They all have an edge to them.
Yes. Yes. It's, yes. Baudrillard might find that interesting if he were alive. But that lesson, which I understand is yours, I think would make some documentary filmmakers become more didactic. In other words, in case you might miss this or in case you might see wrong, I need to make things clear. Whereas I think with your films, it you become, well, certainly not didactic, but you know, they're not as straightforward. I mean, they're open to misinterpretation, like people misinterpreted Fog of War, and like people misinterpreted sometimes Dr. Death, and so I was curious. You give the viewer a lot of credit to figure things out, despite the fact that belief and seeing are often wrong.
I do, and that may be a problem with my art. I don't really know what to say. I mean, I think it's absolutely true what you're saying. It was certainly a problem during the making of Mr. Death. By the way, the title is an impossible title. I wish I had taken my wife's... yes, I wish I had taken my wife's advice and called it What Fred Said, or even better yet, Honeymoon in Auschwitz, two titles that we had considered using. At a certain point, I just felt I'm being too coy. I'm being too elliptical. My wife complains about this, actually. You have to try to be less coy about many, 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 many things. But my experience of investigating stuff is that I often find myself at sea. I find myself entertaining all kinds of contradictory and, I might add, confusing thoughts. Mm. There is no simple answer to many of the questions in this movie. I just don't think that there is.
Yeah.
Why do people take photographs? Why do they take these photographs? What do the photographs show? To me, they're ongoing mysteries that the movie tries in some small way to investigate. But alas, I don't have definitive answers.
Mm.
I think one thing that I can say on behalf of this, and I think it is clear in the movie, you have to correct me if I'm once again self-deceived about everything. This is, well, you can hear left-wing and right-wing pundits argue about whether it's bad apples or policy coming from above.
Right.
We've all been treated to endless arguments of exactly that variety. I didn't want to just simply replicate them. To me, it's one of the most powerful moments in the film when Brent Pack tells you that the picture of the hooded man on the box with wires is standard operating procedure. Yep. It's not me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me making the didactic point. It's something that emerges, I hope, powerfully from the material.
No, I agree. No, I completely agree with that. And I think part of my issue, my difficulty with the film, is that I went in expecting it to be one thing, and it was different.
It's a real problem. I think that is also really, really interesting. On one hand, people talk about how no one will go to see movies about Iraq. And I think one of the reasons is that the expectation is you're going to hear something that you've heard before. Yeah. I believe that you're going to hear something that you have not heard before in this movie. Mm-hmm. It's not your standard. It's not your mother's Iraq movie.
Right.
It's actually something quite different.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased by that.
Yeah, and I think that's right.
By the way, if people really hate this thing, you have no idea of what it was like 20 years ago when The Thin Blue Line came out, and how much criticism there was of the reenactments of what I was doing. I remember one reporter in Dallas asking me, aren't you embarrassed by the fact that you spent so long making an art movie, whereas if you had made a traditional documentary, you could have gotten this guy out of prison a lot sooner? And I thought, geez, I'm a bad guy.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Morris.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jay Robert.
I know you're seeing a lot of movies for the San Francisco Film Festival, and you got a chance to see Errol Morris's Standard Operating Procedure a second time. And you had mentioned in an email that it inspired some more thoughts or more questions, and so I was curious how the second viewing was for you.
Yeah, I also, of course, got to see that in light of your interview, and so I was trying to keep a few things in mind as I saw it again. I think the movie did change for me the second time in several ways. Partly, it's a little better organized, I think, than I realized at first. And partly, this is because I think if you looked at 2 minutes from the second reel and 2 minutes from the fifth reel or something like that, you know, they don't look a lot different. The movie is fairly uniform. And I think it feels like sort of a big pile of information the first time through. The second time through, I felt like he's taking photograph sequences sort of one at a time, roughly chronological, as he told you, something I hadn't really noticed the first time. And then for each one, he's expanding the frame, as someone says in the movie, you can't really see what's outside of the frame of the picture.
Yeah,
he's trying to give the context for each one. And so I almost think if, I hate to question his visual sense, but I think if he had given me a better indication that this is what he's doing, I would have seen the reenactments in a different way. I still have some of the same reservations, but I do think that he's trying to tell us more about what happened in each of those photographs and not just embellish them with scary images, which is the way I read them the first time.
I think that's...
One of the things he told you, though, was that he just wanted to distinguish the visual style of the photos from his reenactments, which that seems I don't want to say disingenuous, but I mean, there are lots of ways to distinguish besides making them hyper aesthetic and crazy in your face, you know?
Well, to give Morris a little bit of credit, or at least to not try to understand where he's coming from. It was clear to me, one of the things that helped me understand the film a little bit better was to read his blog from the New York Times that I did in preparation for the interview, but I hadn't done that when we talked about SOP the first time. And it was reading through that, what he wrote, which I think is really profound and interesting.
Now, these are his essays about reenactments and especially about the Thin Blue Line and
exactly
theory on that.
And you've read those too, haven't you, Rob?
Yeah.
And I think they're really thought-provoking, maybe more thought-provoking than the film. But it was a reminder to me that I know he took an unbelievable amount of crap for the reenactments in Thin Blue Line, you know, which is, what, 20 years old now. And, you know, at that time, it was really a different way of doing things for documentary filmmakers. And so people just sort of really questioned his motives. They questioned whether that was ethical. And it's clear from the New York Times blog pieces is that he's still wrestling with those criticisms to some degree. And so it was... You know, and then when we started talking in the interview, you know, and I'm asking, you know, why do these reenactments in this particular way? I'm not sure it is disingenuous to say that, you know, he wanted to make it very distinctive. I think he didn't want there to be any doubt. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about how the film is structured, and it would be better if it was a little clearer how it's structured. And so I think at certain points he's giving the audience a lot of credit. You know, can you figure out my structure? And then at other points, he's not giving the audience much credit at all when it's like, oh, I have to make these reenactments really obvious. But I do think that it is his attempt to just diffuse any possible arguments that he's being unethical. And again, I agree with you that I don't think he has to go to that extreme. But I do think that that's really what he's trying to do there, even though it's clumsy and has other problems, as we talked about before.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if he gets that sort of criticism nowadays. I mean, because reenactments are just everywhere. And in fact, they were before, too. I mean, Robert Flaherty staged portions of Nanook of the North. I guess people just didn't know that.
Right, right.
And so I can understand, you know, but still, this is a 20-year-old argument, or 20, you know, his argument is old, but...
It's true, but if you go through the New York Times essays, you know, it's clear that that's still on his mind, and it's clear that he's still, you know, kind of fighting that battle with, not about Thin Blue Line so much, but with other documentary filmmakers, you know, what is appropriate? You know, what happens if you, like, there's one, he talks about this documentary, sort of documentary about the civil rights movement, and particularly in Birmingham in 1964, if I remember right, and he talks about this one filmmaker who sort of went back to Birmingham and shot all this new footage, but made it look really old, but didn't tell anyone. And Morris is outraged by that because, you know, he considers that completely unethical. And you get the sense that maybe with standard operating procedure, he wanted to make sure no one was going to be confused, for better or worse.
You know, I liked how Shoa and Night and Fog came up in your interview because
the spectacularly clumsy way.
It's funny that you either misremembered that or miswrote that in your notes, or that one of you misremembered that. Because those two movies are sort of polar opposite views of the Holocaust. Yeah, I was thinking of them in so many ways. I mean, Night and Fog is about 30 minutes and Shoa is 9 hours. Night and Fog is nothing but archival footage. Shoa has not a bit of archival footage. It's just people talking. As someone says in standard operating procedure, it's just words. You know, it's just people giving their memories. So they're like completely opposite views. And yet I feel like they're both so valuable. They're both... you know, masterpieces at looking at the Holocaust. And I've often wondered where Morris's movies fit into this, if this is a continuum from Night and Fog to Shoa, where do they fit in? And they're sort of in the middle because he certainly values people's memories. That's what he's mining in all of his movies.
Yep.
And yet he's also sort of picking them apart, and he gives us another representation of them alongside that is sort of variations of it, to show where they differ, where two people's memories differ, for example, in the Thin Blue Line, or where recollections change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of another movie I saw recently called Respite by Haroon Farooqi. Do you know Haroon Farooqi?
I just know the name, but I haven't seen any of his films.
You know, I'm just now getting into him myself, but his latest movie was at the New York Film Festival, and it's, I think, a 45-minute sort of documentary about this Polish concentration camp, a Nazi concentration camp in Poland. It was originally a refuge for people who were fleeing the Nazis. And then when the Nazis invaded Poland, they turned it into a concentration camp. It wasn't one of the major ones. It was sort of a way station on the way to Auschwitz. But the Nazis were proud of this camp, and the officers who ran it were proud of it, and they had a movie made. So there's this footage of people arriving and people leaving and people working there, and Farocki has assembled it in a silent movie. So there are intertitles explaining what we're seeing, but otherwise it's completely silent. And it's interesting to think about where this falls along this continuum too, because it doesn't show anything horrifying, because that wasn't happening at this camp. You know, the most horrifying thing are sort of the looks on people's faces. Do they know where they're headed, you know? But he points out that there are these scenes where the people who are at this camp, they had to work. So they worked in fields, and they were hoeing fields, and they worked in sort of a factory-like area while they were here. And there are these sequences where they're taking a break from their work in the field, and they all sort of are collapsed on the ground in this sort of heaps. And he doesn't have to show the footage that we've seen in other places like Night and Fog of corpses laying in heaps just like this. But just seeing them live like this, you know what's coming. It's almost like a foreshadow of what's about to happen to them. It's a horrible way he can invoke this image without showing it. And I thought that was a really clever and haunting way to see these images.
And it's interesting to think about, you know, that type of approach depends upon the fact that you have seen other movies or other footage about the Holocaust.
That's right.
Right. In other words, you couldn't have made that kind of movie in 1950 because it wouldn't have anywhere near the same impact that it does 55, 60 years later.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, so did Shoah. I mean, Shoah was made in the 80s,
right.
Night and Fog back in the 50s. And of course, there's other footage we've seen besides what's in Night and Fog, that the memories, the stories that are told in Shoah, you know, just remind you of these things you've seen.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. And in that sense, I think it's interesting to think about standard operating procedure within that. Not that I would ever want to compare what happened at Abu Ghraib to the Holocaust. I mean,
no.
It's you know, there's no equivalence there. But yet it is Morris trying to expose something and to confront it in some way differently than how we've confronted it before. And in that sense, you know, the movie is admirable, even if it isn't quite successful. And my interview with him didn't necessarily change my opinion of that. And how about you seeing it the second time? Did you have a greater appreciation for the film?
As I mentioned before, I actually do think it's a valuable appendix is the way I've sort of been putting it.
Yep.
But I still have reservations about it, and they are similar. They're the same reservations. They're just sort of modified a little bit, I think. For example, the reenactments, I think the visual style affected me less the second time, so that's good. However, I still think that...
Do you think that's because you were prepared for it?
Well, I think it's for two reasons. Yeah, one is I'm prepared for it. The other is I see a method to the madness. You know, I see, first of all, that he's showing us what's outside the frame. Second of all, that he wanted to distinguish them visually from the pictures themselves, which I think is the weaker of those two arguments. But in other words, I sort of see what he's doing a little better than before. I don't see it as completely gratuitous.
Yeah.
But here's an example of where I still have reservations about it. I saw the movie again, I heard your interview, and I also attended a Q&A with him here in San Francisco. And he mentioned that his favorite of the images that he created for this movie was where a drop of blood is dropping on one of the soldiers' uniforms. He's a guy who wasn't directly involved in a lot of the stuff. And he on screen in Morris's interview is talking about he wasn't really involved. Well, he was there, and he does have this drop of blood on his uniform. And Morris sees this image of the drop of blood, which I'm sure you remember dropping onto a uniform, as sort of a metaphor for the entire U.S. involvement. That we're all saying we weren't involved, or, you know, I didn't vote for the guy who did all of this, you know, didn't vote for him the first time, didn't vote for him the second time. And yet, there's a drop of blood on the uniform, you know? I think that's a fantastic metaphor. I think that's a great idea. But I think it's an idea that's not in the movie.
Mm.
There's nothing to distinguish that image from every other image in the movie that's just sort of echoing and mirroring what is being said on the screen. And in some, so in some ways, I think that his ideas that he talks about aren't necessarily in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that also leads to my second reservation, which was about the interviews. I mentioned that these are the bad apples, as they've been called, who are coming before his camera, and that he has a very ambiguous view toward them. And I think the second time, his view looks more sympathetic than I took the first time. Yeah. As I mentioned, I'm used to his previous movies where he lets people sort of hang themselves. And I think that he does that here, which is part of my problem with the movie. But the last stretch of the movie is the each person getting a chance to sort of sum up or say, what would they have done differently? And most of them say, I don't know what I could have done differently. And the first time I saw the movie, I read that as not owning up to their responsibility, of just sort of shrugging and saying, I don't know what I could have done differently. I guess I could have, you know, rebelled and then gone into the brig myself, you know, and I'm not going to do that. And I felt like, well, gosh, maybe you should have. Maybe there's something you could have done, you know? The second time, I felt like it sees them as simply trapped, that there really isn't anything they could have done. In other words, I think that it's possible, one way to read the movie is that he is taking what they're saying at face value. And I'm not actually used to seeing Errol Morris do that.
Right.
At the beginning, I was thinking maybe I should ask him one question. But my question was going to be, you know, something along the lines of, do you feel that this sort of reinforces the official position that this was caused by a few bad apples because they're the only people who appear in your film? And, we don't need you to tell us that Fred Leuchter or Robert McNamara is saying something amazing and ridiculous because he gives us the opportunity to see it with our own eyes and hear it with our own ears. And some of that happens here as well. But by the time I got to the end of the movie, I felt like I had this different feeling that he was more sympathetic to them than I realized. Morris's voice is heard so seldom in his movies that it always sticks in my mind, like in Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. Do you miss Clyde Beatty? You know, one question that you hear always seems very pertinent.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Morris is, I think he's being intentional about that. Absolutely that, you know, he chooses his moments well to insert himself.
Well, and this was another thing that maybe led me astray in standard operating procedure. The first time we hear his voice in this movie is he says to one of the people he's interviewing, didn't you think that was a little weird?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it sets the tone, at least it sort of gave me a clue to what his perception of these interviews was. And I think it led me down this, well, he thinks that they're being a little strange. He feels like they should have had some more responsibility than they do. The second time through, I realized that each time his voice is heard, their answer to his question would not have been clear if we hadn't heard his question. I know he likes to edit such that we don't hear his questions and they're just talking, but they're always responding to something he's said to them, you know? Yep. Where in those cases, each time, it wouldn't have been clear. And so it's almost like just a practical matter that we heard what his question was. And yet it steered me in perhaps the wrong direction. And maybe he doesn't recognize the power of his own style of filmmaking. Not only his question pops up so seldom that it sticks it in our minds, but also the way his cameras tend and his interviews tend to work, that they tend to lead us down a certain path. Both of those things, I think, in order to see this movie as sympathetic to these bad apples, requires me to read it differently, very differently from the way I read his previous movies.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, and for me, it would have been really helpful. For me, the most powerful aspect of standard operating procedure deals with the title itself. You know, when near the end, we have this guy who's kind of a military lawyer who's brought in to analyze the photos and basically say, yeah, that's criminal, or, well, that's standard operating procedure. And I think that's such a powerful moment in the film because, you know, so many of the photos are standard operating procedure. You know, it's like, really? That's what we want our military doing in our name? Is this, you know, things that, you know, are genuinely horrifying. It's like, wow, I don't. And I think if that had somehow been moved up, I realize it might not fit into the structure he has for the film, but it might have set a little bit more of a balance for the movie, or at least given a little bit more guidance to the audience.
It is a great sequence, I think, in part also because it shows how much they're threading the needle. You know, the whole one of the whole points of saying we don't torture is that it is clear and unambiguous and you can say it to anyone and they know what you mean. Where if you're defining it so carefully that you're allowed to do so many things,
yeah,
what's the point?
Yeah. No, that's right. You know, and that's, yeah.
So to give Morris credit, I think he may have been doing that. On the other hand, this is a more cynical view. I think it's possible that it's deliberately ambiguous. So that when he goes to San Francisco, for example, and speaks before a crowd that surely is as liberal as it gets in the U.S., right. outside of possibly the college town just to our east, mm-hmm. you know, it's very easy to sort of provide these extra textual stories and ideas and metaphors that push it slightly in a different direction than it actually shows on the screen, where if you wanted to see it as a complete denial of responsibility, you could.
Yeah, I suspect that Morris would be kind of outraged by that cynical view. I think that there's an element. My expectations of Morris, and this comes from reading things that he's written and, well, you know, sort of a couple brief conversations, is that he almost considers his own views to be obvious, and therefore they don't need to be pushed that hard. You know, and so, and he's such a contrarian, and he's, you know, he's very open about that, that he doesn't want to push something too terribly hard, for fear that, you know, if he were in that position, then he would automatically rebel. And so I'll take him at face value on that. I think for him, he's genuinely trying to point out the fact that these people are sort of trapped, that these people just take the fall for something that, yeah, maybe they could have done it differently. Maybe they should have, you know, tried something differently. But in the end, they walked into a situation that was already in full swing, that had been dictated from the top and had been created, a situation had been created by the people at the top so that people would take the fall. And I think that is Morris's position. And in that sense, his movie is, again, I think, trying to give people a bit too much credit sometimes. And I wish he was a little bit more explicit than he is. But I would expect that he'd be surprised if anyone took it differently.
Well, as I've mentioned many times on this podcast, I love movies that let me do the thinking. Yep. And certainly he does that. Mm.
But?
I want the filmmaker to let me think and come to conclusions on my own. I want him to present ideas, and I want me to come to the movie with ideas, and I want us to sort of create something together, this like alchemy, you know, in the theater, mm-hmm. of new thoughts that maybe neither of us would have thought of separately. But I do want him to come halfway, you know, and mm-hmm. I think with some of the things that he's saying outside of the movie, he hasn't quite done that in the movie. In fact, after he showed the movie in San Francisco, he came out and seemed to want to poll the audience about whether they felt like it was still just caused by a bunch of bad apples. Mm. Well, this audience didn't think that anyway.
Sure.
But people were sort of hesitant, I think, about, well, I guess another way that I could put it is Errol Morris, the investigator, lays out a complicated story in The Thin Blue Line or here. And there, as with any investigation, there are tangents that can be followed. And there are tangents that don't need to be followed because we can seal them off. They were followed and they turned out not to be anything. They were cul-de-sacs. Here, it feels like there are lots of tangents. Each person, as I mentioned before, points to someone else. Well, this was already here when I got here. Right. Someone else did this. Someone else told me, and I thought it was weird, but whatever. If this movie seals all of those off, and I think it implies that they're not important. When really, I think, you know, when he's sort of pitching the movie in person, he'll sort of circle those and say, see, each person was pointing to someone else. It was like this when they got here. Mm-hmm. It's a different emphasis than he typically does, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it gets to a point that you've made both in the first conversation and this, which I think is exactly right, that standard operating procedure works well in the context of other movies about Abu Ghraib, in other words, and what it adds to it. And almost as it feels to me like, you know, if you've seen Taxi to the Dark Side, then this is nice because it provides a little bit more depth or an appendix, as you say, to whereas if you sort of, this was your first exposure to the topic, it might not be as useful.
Yeah. And I love that. And in fact, he said that to you when he said that people want filmmakers just make the same Iraq movie over and over again and say the same thing. We don't actually want that. So I'm glad that he didn't do that. And I do think this is valuable. I think also another thing I realized the second time was the first time I saw the movie, especially in the early parts, as I'm sort of trying to get my bearings, I'm looking for him to make big revelations. Linda England appears on the screen and you think, oh, he got an interview with her. Okay, that's interesting. But what I realized by the end of the movie and was able to see through the entire second viewing was that it's a bunch of little revelations. It's details. This isn't the big overarching explanation of what happened. This is telling you, did you know in that famous picture there was actually someone else standing on the left who was cropped out? Or did you know that this picture that you may have seen, it didn't play out exactly the way you thought? Or did you ever think about how these photos were arranged chronologically? You know, those are all very good details, and I think you're right that it works best if you come with some context, as he, the filmmaker, did.
Yep. No, I think that's right. And also, too, when you talk about sort of the investigation aspect of Morris's personality and how he sort of, you know, wanted to talk to the audience about in San Francisco about what they thought, I even noticed that in the interview. I don't remember if this comes up at the end of the interview, but as the interview was ending, and I was kind of being shooed out the door by the publicist, even though I had several more questions I wanted to ask. Morris made a point of talking about how much he enjoyed the last part of the interview where we were disagreeing, that he really liked that, and he really likes it when people talk about what they don't like about the film.
I like trouble, he told you.
and it was pretty clear. It's not that he, again, I think part of that's just because he's kind of a contrarian. He sort of likes that in other people too. But for him, I noticed that the parts of the conversation that he was most interested in were the ones in which he got a sense of how I had perceived the film. In other words, it was really important to him to try to understand how other people were watching his film. And I found that a bit surprising and also interesting. I think he is genuinely interested in how people look at it, and maybe because he's not sure how people look at it. And so it helps him to kind of this conversation about it. So I agree that metaphor of the blood on the jacket is a really powerful metaphor, but I just can't get past what a beautiful image it is and how distracting that is. It was interesting when you read the New York Times essays that Morris wrote. He focuses a lot on in the Thin Blue Line of the milkshake cup flying through the air. And he's really proud of that image. You can tell he's really proud that he somehow it's a very similar metaphor, right? He's really proud that in one single image he captures everything he wants to say. And so when you're describing the blood on the uniform, I can almost imagine Moore saying, I need that milkshake moment in this movie. Ah, there's my milkshake moment. But for me, what's troubling about that, and it's troubling in Thin Blue Line as well, is that's what people remember. And the question is, what have they remembered? In other words, have they been so distracted by the power of this single image that they've forgotten whatever else is in the movie? And I don't think that's necessarily going to happen in standard operating procedure. But I think that is the danger of sort of creating beautiful images out of things that are genuinely ugly, that what you leave people with is almost a comforting, beautiful idea that then lets them leave their seats and go about their business as if nothing had happened except they saw something pretty for an hour and a half. So
The sort of flip side of that might be the dog snarling into the camera, which maybe that would be the strongest image that would stick with me, which is a disturbing and unsettling image, especially when it's combined with these sound effects. And maybe that was the intention that, imagine what it would feel like to have this dog snarling in your face.
And I know, and this goes back to a movie that you and I disagree about, but I'm not a huge fan of it either, but Michael Winterbottom's Road to Guantanamo, you know, the thing that sticks with me most from that film is towards the end, where Michael Winterbottom kind of recreates this how they break prisoners down at Guantanamo with you know, this unbelievably loud, you know, piercing music and sound and isolation. And I just found that to be really, really powerful in that film, because it's like, you know, Isn't this torture? I mean, wouldn't this be torture under any definition of the word, to be sort of stuck in a room like this for hours and hours and hours on end? And so, you know, I find that even more effective in Winterbottom's film than I do in Morris's film.
And that's a movie that, by the way, is almost entirely reenactments, you know, 95% reenactment.
Yep.
So much that I'm not sure why it falls under, you know, the documentary section of the video store.
Well, and as I wrote in my review of that film, I think the movie is flawed because we're not quite sure what's real. I think the movie suffers greatly for that. Although I find myself sympathetic with it for other reasons. Well, that's interesting. It doesn't sound like your general opinion was changed, but certain things were deepened by the second viewing. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, that probably exhausts everything Rob and I can say about the movie, but I heartily encourage you to check out the blog Errol Morris has been writing on the New York Times website, in which he discusses not only his own film, but other documentaries and the ethical implications of reenactments, and also just how we as viewers see reality. You can find the link at our website, erratamag.com. That's erratamag.com. Rob and I will be back next time with another speed round as we look at several movies that have come out this spring, including those precious independent films Iron Man and Indiana Jones and the title that goes on forever. Until then, bye.